Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Monday, June 12th, 2017.
All right. And then with that, I will open an informational meeting with the House Committee on Energy and the Environment.
Okay, great. Steve, you want to come up? So the focus of today's informational hearing, colleagues and members of the audience, is a look at California's cap and trade program with a particular focus on rural California and what some of the ways are that that program has been intersecting with the particular needs faced by rural Californians, and looking to that as, you know, a potential model for us here, lessons learned, things to avoid, things to embrace, how it's been going. And we have two speakers before us today. One of them is on the phone. That's Arjun Patni, who's the policy director of the American Carbon Registry. And then, very pleased to see again, Steve Frisch from Sierra Business Council, who's come up from California, and who I think just met with the Association of Oregon Counties?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. Okay, Arjun, would you like to lead us off and give us your perspective on what you've seen in the California experience and what lessons we can learn from it? And if you could just start by giving us your name for the record, please.
Yes, this is Arjun Patni from the American Carbon Registry. And just FYI, I don't see the broadcast coming through the internet. I don't know if it's on my end. If it is, that's fine. But just to let you know, in case the problem is on that.
We can see it here.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Beth Riley for the record, when the committees are meeting jointly, it only streams under one of the names and then it will be updated later. So it may be under the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee meeting right now.
Which are you looking at? You're looking at the House, Arjun?
I'm looking at the Senate.
Probably not the House.
Okay, I don't have to see it. So.
Yeah, well, you can look at the House. It's not quite as good, but it's probably good enough.
Right now, it's the only game in town.
Yeah, it's better than nothing. Let's put it
that way.
You're fewer in number, so it's weird that you put it under the House.
Okay, we can see your slideshow here, Arjun.
Okay, well, that's fine. Chair Dembrough, Chair Helm, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I will tell you about the experience with offsets in rural communities, particularly in California. And we can go to the second slide, if you like. So I'll give you a bit of background on the American Carbon Registry, ACR, which is part of a larger organization called WinRock International. WinRock was established as the assemblage of three predecessor organizations that were created by Whitsup Rockefeller, the former governor of Arkansas. We do work both in the U.S. and overseas, more of it outside the U.S., a lot of USAID contracts focused on economic development, resource management, and social equity, and climate change is a material part of our work. Third slide. So ACR was founded in 1996, the first voluntary greenhouse gas registry in the country, possibly the world, I'm not sure. And since that time, we've issued more than 80 million carbon offsets. The role that we play is to develop and approve carbon offset protocol or methodology, to use those terms interchangeably. We review and register projects. We oversee third-party verifiers. We issue the offset into the account, and we track the transactions and retirees. So in those last two roles, we act much like a bank. So you have your account at your bank, and funds can be transferred from one account to another, and the bank is not party to the transaction. So similarly, different companies, different compliance entities have their accounts with us. The difference is that we issue the currency into the account, and the credits may be transferred from one account to another or retired when they're used to offset GHG emissions. And since 2012, at the inception of the California Cap and Trade Program, we've been an approved offset project registry, which means that we can we work with the state and we issue offsets that can then be converted into compliance instruments for the program. There are three approved registries. There were two of us initially, and then a third one approved. We'll go to the fourth slide. You should see a list of California compliance offset protocols. So you may have seen this before. These are the six protocols that can be used for compliance in California. All of these were based on protocols developed in the voluntary market by the registries, and then the Air Resources Board goes through a rulemaking process as for any other regulations, and they'll take stakeholder input and always make some tweaks to the protocols, and then they will issue the official compliance protocol, which is then what we follow for any offset projects that are intended to be used for compliance purposes in California. The first one, forestry, they've all so far been improved forest management projects. We also have livestock manure digesters, rice cultivation, destruction of ozone depleting substances, which is, for example, old freon, that aside from being an ozone depleting substance, is also very, very potent greenhouse gas. Mine methane captures, so for example, capturing, flaring, or using for power, the methane from abandoned coal mines, and urban forestry. So next slide. You should see a table with the offsets generation in California. We have close to 58 million offsets that have been issued so far. The great majority you can see there is from improved forest management projects, about 36 million so far, but also material amounts from destruction of ozone depleting substances, livestock digesters, and mine methane. You'll note that we haven't had any offsets from urban forestry or from rice cultivation. Urban forestry has been a protocol since the program's inception, and unfortunately, the economics just have not worked out for those sorts of projects. Rice cultivation was only recently, in fact, the most recently, adopted protocol. So that is one issue. So, I mean, that's one reason I would say is why we haven't seen any yet. But I have to say that it does appear there will be some problems, some challenges to the economics of those projects as well with regard to the scale of the farming operations, the credits per acre, and therefore whether the economics, project development and verification can support, those can be overcome by the revenue from selling the offset. So then that type of issue does arise with other agricultural protocols. A little bit later I'll get into those challenges and how they might be addressed as well. So we can move on from that. So just think, the forest carbon projects that we've seen in Oregon so far, just so I'd highlight them here. For California Cap and Trade, we have three so far. The second one, Green Diamond Climate East, has already issued the credits. The Warm Springs Tribal Project should be issuing fairly soon. It's a fairly large project. And then Green Diamond Climate West is in progress. There was also a voluntary project that has issued credits. City of Astoria put it together, Bear Creek Watershed. So we've had a few projects in Oregon already. I imagine we would see a lot more if Oregon were part of the program too. So we'll go to the next one. I'll just highlight, I'll get into some of the agricultural offset protocols we have that have not yet been, for which project types under do not yet exist for compliance purposes. It's first probably good to get a snapshot of where the emissions come from in the ag sector. So as you can see, about half of them come from the N2O emissions associated with fertilizer application. Also a lot come from enteric methane, cowpers, et cetera, and manure methane, is also a significant source of those emissions. To the next one. So fertilizer management, ACR does have a couple of protocols. It involves things like using less fertilizer, precision application, a fertilizer, nitrogen stabilizers, various ways to use less fertilizer, therefore limiting the N2O emission. N2O reductions are, of course, permanent. There's no way of reversing that that greenhouse gas benefit, unlike a sequestration project, you know, where the sequestered carbon, say, in a forestry project that could be, you know, a forest fire or a pest infestation or something like that, that could cause those trees to die or be destroyed and then the release of that carbon. The N2O reductions can be implemented across a wide range of crops and geographic areas. I looked it up, and in Oregon has somewhere between 2 and 4 million fertilized acres. So there's some potential there as well. Low-cost reductions, and there are, of course, water quality benefits from avoided nutrient runoff into waterways. I know that there are some organizations in Oregon with whom we've had some discussions in the past on collaboration and who work on water quality credits there. I know Freshwater Trust is one of those. So perhaps there's an intersection there. Grazing land and livestock management. This is the protocol where we've tried to bring together various practices to improve the economics of these projects. So it's the combined climate benefit of such approaches as methods of reducing enteric fermentation emissions, manure management such as digesters, improved fertilizer application, and a couple of other ways as well. It's modular, so pieces of that can be used, some or all of that can be used. And in addition to the efficiency gain by combining practices, the quantification of the carbon benefit, the complexity of that quantification is scaled to the size of the farming operation. So for a small farming operation, we have a more streamlined quantification approach. And for a larger one, it's a more complex quantification. And another one is compost addition to grazed grassland. Some research at UC Berkeley has gone into developing this one, and it was the USDA grant to EDF that went into this as well. So a one-time application of compost is being shown to sequester between 1 and 5 tons of CO2 per acre per year. And the one-time application has a long-lasting and year-on-year benefit as well, as defined in the research. The benefit comes from the migration of the organic material into the soil, but more of the benefit comes from the increased vegetation and the CO2 that's absorbed by the vegetation and then forms carbon pools in the soil. And they found that if 5% of California's rangelands were to use this, they could sequester perhaps 28 million tons of CO2 per year. I'll move on to wetlands. California wetland restoration. So this is one that we just recently approved, although we've had one for the Mississippi Delta for some time. The soil oxidizes in these areas, such as some parts of the Central Valley, and that releases CO2. By restoring the wetland, that process is stopped. In addition, we have more vegetation, which is absorbing CO2. There is some methane generation from the degradation of organic material in the water, but that is outweighed by the CO2 benefits. There are obviously some co-benefits to this as well, such as habitat creation and flood protection. Move on to the next one, which we just had a couple of pictures there that just illustrate the real change in the landscape, the real deteriorated landscape beforehand, and then after the wetland is restored, you can see a much more vibrant area there. slide, you should see a flow chart. It shows how we work with the California Air Resources Board. I don't know if what you're seeing shows the whole flow chart or all at once. I mean, or piece by piece. But if it's not showing the whole thing, then it's just quick through, so it shows the whole thing. Outside project developers submit their projects to a registry first. And they provide detailed information as is specified in the regulation. We make sure that is all complete as per what the requirements of the regulation is, the requirements of the regulation and the protocol. The project operator selects a verifier. The registries make sure that there is no conflict of interest. For example, that the verifier has not previously done some consulting for the project operator. Once the project has been implemented, then the verifier will make sure that it has followed the protocol requirements and that the quantification of greenhouse gas reduction is correct. We will then check that again when the information is submitted to us. Also, as per the regulation, the registries are required to audit at least 10% of the projects, and we've always exceeded that, usually closer to a quarter of them. And what that means actually is that we participate from beginning to end. In the first kickoff meeting, through field visits to the projects, through to the final issuance of credits. So once we've reviewed all the information and issued credits on our registry, then when those are to be used for compliance, and we issue what are called registry offset credits. When those are to be used for compliance, we send the information over to the ARB. They take a final look at it. When they sign off on it, then they reissue credits on the WCI system, and we will cancel those credits on our registry so that there's no double counting. Along the way during this process, we do provide some technical guidance to the project developers for any issues that might come up for them to understand regulatory interpretations. We don't create regulatory interpretations. For that, we have weekly calls with the ARB. All the registries do on one call to sift through issues that arise with respect to interpretation of the road rules. Those are ways that we help sort of act as an intermediary to get the projects through the process. Next slide, you should see some information about the Washington State model. Just for information, they've taken a somewhat different approach to offset. Their program just kicked off on January 1st. Rather than adopting state protocols, they've chosen to simply recognize outside protocols from the voluntary sector. So, for example, they've written in 9 of ACR's protocols into their rules. And then the offsets that we issue against those protocols are directly usable as compliance instruments for the program. So they've taken a more streamlined approach to the use of incorporation of offsets into their program. Lastly, I'll get into, if you want to move the slide forward, I'll get into lessons from California's experience with offsets and agricultural projects. At current carbon prices, costs can be a barrier to offset project types that have low volumes, and we have fragmented farming operations and few credits per acre. One thing that could address this is aggregation. So if we could aggregate multiple farming operations into one project, that would provide for an economy of scale that could overcome more easily the cost of data collection and monitoring and verification. Unfortunately, that is not possible in California, and that's because the regulation here has invalidation provisions. So ARB has the power to go back several years, and if problems are found retroactively with respect to environment, health, and safety violations or the integrity of the credits, then ARB has the power to go back and invalidate those credits. And if they need the ability to identify which credits are being invalidated. exactly from which project, which landowner. And so they need that enforcement power, and that just allows the possibility of aggregation to identify the property. In Quebec and likely in Ontario, they're taking a different approach, a buffer pool approach. So a small portion of the credits from each project are set aside for a buffer pool. And if there is ever a need for, if it's ever found that there are some credits that perhaps should not have been issued, then they will simply retire an equal number of credits from the buffer pool to account for those credits that that they deem should not have been issued. And so with that approach, that allows for aggregation because the regulatory agency doesn't need the ability to go and identify exactly which credits need to be invalidated. Next slide. A couple of other lessons. One thing is that we're finding with the investment of proceeds here, it would be useful if those programs were compatible with offset protocols, particularly looking at sequestration.
Oops. Arjun, we lost you. Can you hear me?
And if he can?
He's waving.
Try again.
I can try giving him a call back. It sounded like he cut off there.
Chris, you'll try to get in touch with him?
Yes,
okay. All right, well, that's a perfect segue to Steve.
Great. Perfect.
Yeah, we'll take advantage of this and go into yours, Steve. Steve, welcome.
Great.
Thanks for coming up.
Let's remember where Arjun is so we can pick up on the lessons learned when we come back. So thank you, Chair Dembrough and Vice Chair Power. I appreciate being here today to talk a bit about our perspective on the California experience. So my name is Steve Frisch. I'm the president of the Sierra Business Council and the Sierra Small Business Development Center, which serves Northeastern California. So our organization is a network of roughly 4,000 small business owners in a rural region of California. We represent the entire Sierra Nevada region, so from Kern County in the south to Modoc County in the north. About 80% of our membership is small businesses, and about 20% is local governments, cities, and counties, and other nonprofit organizations or just good citizens in the region. The Small Business Development Center that we represent, or the region that we represent, is the northeastern corner of California from Lake Tahoe to the Oregon border, north to the Oregon border, and from the Nevada border down to the Sacramento, the North Sacramento Valley. So all of northeastern California, about 465,000 residents. So I wanted to give you a couple of observations about the California experience and our experience working on this policy in a rural region of California. Our organization began working on cap and trade policy actually before, or I should say climate policy, actually before California's AB 32 law passed in 2006. So when there was discussion at the state level that they would be looking at legislation, we were interested, and I have to honestly say, concerned about the impact on small business, particularly in a rural region of the state, and got involved in several of the working groups that were looking at developing policy. And I can honestly say that most business people in our region were skeptical as well. and we're concerned that that implementation of a climate policy in California would be bad for business. So, and what we have discovered over the last 11 years now is actually the opposite, which is a bit of a surprise to us. So what we've discovered is that the implementation of climate policy has had a number of positive net impacts in our region. Number one, it's been a powerful tool for economic development within the region. As people have begun to invest in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and in all of the different types of projects that are necessary to do that, including things like new sources of generation, investments in energy efficiency, both at the residential and at the commercial and industrial level, sustainable transportation projects, including things like low-carbon fuels and electric vehicle charging networks, investments in sustainable agriculture, investments in forest and watershed restoration, that between 2008 at the beginning of the policy and 2015, just in that northeastern California corner, or Assembly District 1 in California, it's created about $530 million of investments over that 10-year period and just under 20,000 jobs. Many of those jobs are middle income. Some of them are entry-level jobs, no doubt, in things like the energy efficiency and the solar field. Admittedly, sometimes it's difficult to measure full-time equivalency jobs versus temporary employment. But there's really good data coming out of the California Air Resources Board, the California Department of Business, Transportation, and Housing, and others now, that are showing a direct link between job creation in California and implementation of climate policy. It's also been a powerful driver for natural resource restoration in certain regions of our state, in particular forested and wetland regions, areas like Arjun was talking about, where not only implementation of projects to directly intervene in the landscape to improve carbon sequestration, but also these third-party markets for offsets that create revenue for private landowners have been incredibly important. It's been an interesting, I have to admit at times it's been slow to get to the rural regions, but it is beginning to have an impact on the transportation infrastructure in our region. So beginning to see electric charging networks being done up and down state highways and at destination locations through the rural regions of the state of California in order to address that range anxiety issue for people with electric vehicles. So now we are beginning to see kind of the impact of having electric charging stations across the state, which we are hoping will begin to increase kind of the desirability of electric vehicles. And then finally, one place where it's really had a significant impact in our region has been increasingly in housing. As you all know, I think the cost of housing across California is a huge problem. As a matter of fact, there was recently a study for the Brookings Institute looking at housing burden across the country, and California had the highest housing burden as a percentage of average household income of any state in the union. But by investing portions of the revenue derived from the cap and trade program, which is one of the implementing measures of our AB 32 legislation, in housing, we've been able to start placing housing next to transportation networks and job centers. And actually, over the last 2 years, our organization has leveraged about $26 million into our region for affordable housing alone, which we're really proud of. All told, our Small Business Development Center over the last 3 years has leveraged about $100 million of climate investment in that northeastern corner of California. Some of that not deployed yet, so it will be seen in the next decade's numbers. There are some lessons learned, I think. And, you know, as a Californian, I'm really proud of our state leading on this policy. As a rural resident, I'm also cognizant of the point that often rural regions get thought of second, which is unfortunate. And I do think that we have made some mistakes in our policy that I would love to see following people address. So one is the idea that in developing these sorts of policies, a low carbon fuel standard, a renewable portfolio standard, an energy efficiency standard, a cap and trade or a cap and invest program, looking at how all of those work together in order to achieve these other objectives that you might have, whether it's job creation or it's kind of changing and acting as an economic development driver in certain industries or sectors or regions of the state, or looking at how the aggregated policies actually affect things like budget stability, whether or not portions of that revenue can be used in order to offset costs that would be accrued in other programs. It's a really, really good idea. So the alignment of policy and the integration of policy to meet a greater goal overall. I think we're getting there in California as the policies are being implemented on the ground. We're beginning to get more alignment between these policies so that the kind of total is greater than the sum of its parts. But starting with that thought would be a really good idea. Another significant issue is equitable distribution of funding. So I don't think there was a lot of thought at the beginning of our process about how we would make sure every region of the state and the appropriate sectors of the economy benefited from the distribution of funding from the program. And because of that, there were certain areas of the state that ran the risk of being left behind. And I'm thinking in particular rural regions, disadvantaged communities, and low-income households. So that idea of planning into the programs in advance some very clear and transparent mechanisms, first, for protecting the most vulnerable people in the community to the prices associated with this, and second, to equitable distribution of funding across the state in order to meet your long-term policy objectives. And I'd say the final lesson learned for us has been the need to create flexibility in these programs. And in particular, this is an entirely new universe of kind of creating projects to reduce carbon emissions. And in some of them, we're seeing really tremendous results. In some of them, we're not seeing the results that we want to see yet, or they need to be measured over a longer time period in order to think about what the net effect is. So when you're designing programs to actually implement the policy, looking at that issue of how do you create flexibility within the program so you can meet your objectives and so that you don't have to keep coming back either for a legislative fix or for an administrative fix. So more flexibility on the part of program administrators. Then another region that we think has been really interesting, or another set of issues that we think has been really interesting that is emerging in the California program, is this question of how do you value and plan for co-benefits? So I'm emphasizing the point that one of the co-benefits of implementing a climate policy is local economic development. But how do you value that when you're trying to figure out what's a rational system for distributing funding to meet the overall policy objective? And there are other co-benefits that you want to take into consideration as well. So, for example, there's a suite of economic co-benefits. There's a suite of natural resource co-benefits. A co-benefit, for example, of forest restoration is improved water supply in California or resilience to drought in California. But we never worked into our systems a mechanism for considering co-benefits and valuing them in the distribution of funding around the programs. With that said, I think it's really important to note that the California kind of policy is seeing some pretty tremendous results. So California is the sixth largest economy in the world. And probably sometime this year, it will become the fifth largest economy in the world. And since we started implementing these programs in 2011, really the decisions were made in 2001, but the implementation, once the policy got put together, really started investing in the programs themselves in about 2010, 2011. We've seen since 2008 an 18% increase in California's gross domestic product, a 5% increase in California's population, an 8% decrease in greenhouse gas emissions, and a 20% per capita decrease in greenhouse gas emissions. So I think one of the things that we're beginning to see is that we can have double the rate of employment growth, and granted there are other external factors that are driving that, but you can actually begin to envision a universe where you're decoupling economic growth and GDP growth from greenhouse gas emissions. And indeed, we're beginning to see that happen as we're seeing investments, for example, in renewable energy and electrical generation and other things where the prices per kilowatt hour charged at a wholesale rate are beginning to come down for some sources of power. Solar and wind are competitive with fossil fuels today. I'm working on a biomass utilization project where we can supply biopower at 8.3 cents per kilowatt hour. We're having a hard time selling it because solar is coming in at 5.1 cents a kilowatt hour. So this issue of beginning to see economic growth decoupled from GDP is beginning to reach the sectors of the economy as well. And then finally, I wanted to kind of spend just a minute talking about what rural regions really need when it comes to implementing policies like this. So I think it's extremely difficult for local governments or economic development entities to be involved in a state policy framework that is this complicated, this difficult to track, that has so many different moving parts. And the reality is what rural regions lack the most is the capacity to engage in a way that they can truly benefit from these sorts of programs. Our organization has tried to play that intermediary role where we work directly with businesses and local governments to improve their access to funding. Often that means working with them to help design projects that are likely to qualify for funding, working with them to put together the project proposals or the grant applications that go into those programs for funding based on requests for proposals. And then actually, once funding is allocated, working with them directly to find and leverage matching private sector funding to meet the project objectives, which I think is a really interesting opportunity for rural regions in this. It's very difficult to get investment capital for larger scale projects in rural regions, particularly things like electrical generation infrastructure projects. So to the extent that we can use public funding to leverage private investment in rural regions, it really makes a big difference in rural economic development. So one of the things that we've been working on over the last 2 or 3 years is creating a small revolving loan fund we can use to invest in projects like this, aggregated funding from CDFIs and from the Small Business Administration and from the USDA. And then another thing that we've been working on has been kind of working with sources of capital, so investment firms, socially responsible investment funds, et cetera, to bring them into the project design phase of many of these projects in order to make sure that they're meeting what their requirements are for placing capital in those projects. So we have people that are working on this whole issue of linking public funding and private funding together in order to meet the objectives. Some of those through public-private partnerships, but some of those through direct investment in private sector firms. And then the last thing that I wanted to mention is that as we've been looking at how this works in rural regions, one of the things that's really become apparent to us, and that I have to admit our region was skeptical of these programs to begin with, is the preference that has, even though it's been complicated, even though California's had its problems implementing the policy, even though our carbon pricing mechanism, which has been primarily a cap and trade program, has been challenged in court and is now, I think, overcoming those challenges, that in the long run, I think there is an overwhelming agreement amongst the business community in California that a cap and trade or cap and invest program has been preferable to what the alternatives have been, which have been either a direct carbon tax that doesn't really create a buffer for consumers to price shock in the case of implementing that tax on a straight dollars per ton basis, or direct regulation. By creating a market with flexibility that gives businesses the ability to figure out the best way to reduce their carbon emissions, that gives them an incentive for doing so. That is, if you reduce your emissions more than what you're capped at, you have a commodity that can be sold on the market. It creates a tremendous driver for business innovation within our state, and we are indeed seeing that happening now with new firms being created for things like water and agricultural technology, irrigation technology, distributed energy networks, people investing, for example, in biofuels in order to meet the low carbon fuel standard requirements. We are really beginning to see the business innovation side of it really, really kick in, which is kind of exciting. So our advice to you would be, if you want equitable distribution of funding across the state — I am a ruralist, I admit it, I'm proud of it, right? You really need to think about it up front and design systems in a way that you ensure you're investing in rural communities to increase their capacity and to give them the ability to have access to these funds to drive business innovation into rural regions. It can be a tremendously powerful tool for economic development in rural regions while reducing greenhouse gas emissions at the same time. And if we've learned one thing, I wish we had done that to begin with, but we're going to keep doing it now. We're shooting for that now. So. Thank you, if you have any questions.
Okay, thanks a lot, Steve. So we have Arjun back. So why don't we, before we take questions — I know I have some questions, I'm sure others do — let's have Arjun do his last slide, and then we'll open it up to questions for both.
Hello? Hello? Oh, perfect.
Arjun, welcome back.
Hi there. Thank you. I just thank you, Chair Devereaux and Chair Helm. Thank you.
Yeah.
I can see the screen now as well. So that's
okay, great. So have you been able to listen to Steve in his presentation?
Yes. Yeah, but that was helpful also.
I assume you agree with everything he said, but we'll see about that. Okay, why don't you carry on, and then we're going to take questions from both of you, directed at both of you.
Just on my last slide there, I suggest that the auction revenue program should be compatible with offset protocols. Highlighting as an issue there, sequestration, funding for sequestration projects such as wetlands restoration, and now the Healthy Soils Initiative, which is being designed now for compost applications to rangeland. the summer programs can ensure that sequestration happens for, say, 3 years, but offset protocols could improve more.
Now we're losing you again, Arjun.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
Okay. That's not to say that sequestration would be immediately reversed, but having that year-on-year offset revenue would help to provide a greater assurance of the permanence. We're working to get those quantification methods aligned, but it would be good to have the direction to align those methods in the first place. The last point is, this is not just specific to rural, there's interest in more in-state California offsets. There's an objection to funding projects in faraway places, and I think it's something to it's worth considering, giving DEQ the latitude to allow Oregon compliance entities the ability to use a higher limit for in-state projects and perhaps no limit on Oregon projects. There, of course, could be concerns about whether that's compatible with WCI linkage, for WCI linkage, and so that's why I suggested the discretion, taking that into account. Although there are conversations happening right now in California about making those sort of tweaks for the California program, and so if California were to do that, that would certainly give more latitude to its partners to do similar things. So those are my suggestions, and I hope you found the observations through my presentation helpful, and the information about what offset possibilities exist for rural areas. And I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Arjun. Okay, as we move into questions, actually, let me lead off by kind of forming a bridge between your two presentations. Steve, you in yours focused on direct investments into the rural areas as a result of cap and trade revenues. But I'm sure that offsets also play a role in those areas that you represent. Can you say something about the relationship between the two?
Absolutely. So by working within the cap and trade program and creating what is essentially the opportunity for people to offset additional emissions, thus creating a market for the types of projects that the American Carbon Registry is verifying, essentially. What you're doing is you're essentially creating opportunities in you know, actually everywhere, but potentially in rural regions, for those offset projects to be done in the rural places, whether they're methane capture or soil carbon sequestration or forest carbon sequestration, et cetera. And that's really giving rural landowners, because many of these projects are done in rural places, another way to essentially derive benefit from their land ownership within the region. It's another revenue stream that can be used or filtered into how they're using their land in a way that will eventually meet that policy. I think the link between offsets and cap and trade is essentially creating kind of that clear, verifiable process for landowners to be able to use their land in an economically beneficial way that meets the carbon policy as well. And we are seeing many of those projects in California. I'm actually with Arjun on, well, Arjun mentioned that California is hoping that more of those projects will be done in California. I'm totally with him on that. I'm actually supporting policy that will encourage more of the offset projects to be done within the state of California so that we can derive the economic
benefit. But don't go too far with that just yet.
We like Oregon. How about this? Within Western Climate Initiative partner jurisdictions.
I like that. I like that. Okay. Questions, colleagues? Senator Roblin.
Thank you very much. And I guess I'll start with, you know, what kind of rural investments are you getting in your, you know, so particulars, what kinds of things are actually happening, money being spent in rural areas to improve economic development
so,
and be sustainable?
A lot of the investment to begin with has been things like solar installation, energy efficiency installation, transportation type projects, including expanding rural transportation networks or installing electric vehicle charging networks. We've seen a lot of investment in rural power generation, both, well, largely solar in our region, or biomass is beginning to be economically viable again in our region. So we're working on a couple of biomass projects right now. And then forest treatment and forest management type projects. Although, honestly, the majority of that employment growth has come within, you know, two industries, solar and energy efficiency. So, and, you know, we would argue it's really important to create a link between the deployment of those programs and career technical education programs at high schools and community colleges in order to create an employment path for young people within the region, and that they have a tendency to be, although not necessarily high-paid jobs, they have a tendency to be higher-paid jobs than service industry economies in rural regions, which is really important.
Representative Holby.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Senator Roblin's question, because I was thinking about the same thing a little bit. You had mentioned that, you know, some of these projects or some of these investments, and correct me if I misheard it, but there were co-benefits, including things about water supply in your region. And so I'm wondering what projects are we talking about, piping irrigation canals or, you know, things like that? Or is there investments? What investments are really directly, I guess, a co-benefit of water supply?
Actually, you made a really important point. I have a tendency to speak from a forest community perspective rather than an agricultural community perspective. So in California's Central Valley and Sacramento Valley and Monterey and Imperial and Coachella, there has been a lot of direct investment, for example, in irrigation technology and essentially what's known as the water energy nexus, right? 20% of all electricity in California is to move water, which is kind of scary. If we didn't have to lift it over the mountains to LA, it would be about 10%. So, so the type of co-benefit that you're going to see there, you know, you have the economic benefits of the employment for people deploying those projects, but you also might see co-benefits in projects like that, more resilience in the water supply, meaning that you have to spend less money on storage. In California, 80% of the developed water supply is for agriculture, 20% is for urban uses. So imagine what you can do if you improve water efficiency by 10% or 15% in agricultural regions. You eliminate the need for additional storage, which is extremely expensive and almost impossible for us to get through our political processes in California, right? So that's the type of co-benefit. But let's go back to the forest community co-benefit, because this is one that I feel really closely, and back to the water issue. You know, California has huge swaths of overgrown forest that need thinning, and we have largely lost our timber industry in most of at least northeastern and central California. There's still some on the north coast and in the Cascade region, but less in the Sierra Nevada. Though that has a price on the cost of firefighting, on our air quality, and it has a price on California's water supply, because the overgrown forest not only uses more water, but it also retains more snow in the upper canopy, so there's more evapotranspiration of that water. It never even hits the ground, so it doesn't go into California's water system. We have scientific research that shows anywhere from an 8 to a 20% increase in water yield in certain watersheds in California if the forest had been managed essentially the way it was in a pre-European condition. 20% of that water supply is a huge co-benefit when you think about the cost of storing, impounding, moving that water around the state of California. So.
Just a quick follow-up. So those types of projects, you know, absent this cap and invest type of system, would you say probably wouldn't have happened?
Not yet. Some of them may have. I would argue that investments in things like the transportation network, I mean, we've had a real problem in California funding transportation. Without the cap and trade funding, I'm not sure many of those projects would have been funded. The housing side of it has been incredibly important. Reducing vehicle miles traveled by building affordable housing in the right places in the state. I don't think those projects would have been done absent the cap and trade funding. And I certainly know that the forest management projects, the type of projects that Arjun's talking about too, the forest and wetland restoration projects, definitely not. Because there simply hasn't been enough funding in the state. And when we have passed funding measures for those purposes, they have a tendency to target, with all due respect, urban areas. So.
Let me follow up on that. And this is directed to you, Arjun. You know, the offset programs are probably going to emphasize things like sequestration. And so, you know, from that perspective, keeping forests intact. The problem with that is, you know, that doesn't help with unemployment and, you know, finding good jobs for people, whereas forest health projects are more likely to do so. Do you see a kind of tension between those two? I know you're just looking at the carbon savings of a project, but we, of course, have to also consider the employment side of projects as we're trying to overcome those challenges that low-income rural people are facing.
Sure. Chair Devereaux, Chair Allen, thank you for the question. No, I understand that, you know, that perceived tension. I would say that harvesting is still allowed under these practices of improved forest management. And so I guess, you know, with the, and with that, and considered with the state of the timber markets as well, you know, we haven't experienced a trade-off between timber employment and the benefits of more sustainable management. And what we would suggest is that the improved forest management practices tend to reward better managers, and we haven't, you know, we haven't seen a trade-off with respect to jobs in the sector at this point.
That's great. And Steve, has that been your experience?
I would agree with that. That's been our experience as well. As a matter of fact, our experience has been that that better forest management in line with what would be required to qualify under the protocols for a forested project is a more likely path to employment in our region than timber harvest right now, quite frankly. We have not had enough of a market that it's been encouraging it, and I would argue it can actually support a smart, long-term, sustainable timber harvest strategy for a company.
So what kind of numbers have you seen in terms of employment in sustainable harvesting? Have you seen increases in numbers?
Yeah, so this has been a really hard one for us to quantify, okay? And the reason is that there are so many externalities on the timber market that it's been very difficult for us to figure out whether or not improvements in employment in specific areas are tied specifically to kind of these programs. We can look at individual projects and know that they will be. I'm working on a project right now to restart a 20-megawatt biomass facility. We have direct economic analysis that shows that will create 124 direct jobs in the community with a multiplier effect of roughly 2.3 jobs in the surrounding area, right? We can look at individual projects and know that it hired a certain number of foresters for a certain period of time. But looking across the entire geography, we are still losing jobs in the timber industry in California. So it's been hard to really determine.
Senator Roblin.
So kind of in the same line, if I was hearing it right, offsets can only be in duration, 3-year durations. So if we have an offset set up with a particular project, could that project then reauthorize more credits after that 3-year project if they continue? How does that work?
I want to pass that one to Arjun as the offset protocol expert.
Sure. Chair Dembrough, Chair Helm, Representative Roblin, thank you. So I think maybe I wasn't clear. So when I mentioned that 3-year funding cycle, I was speaking to the investment of the auction revenue and the funding cycle of the government program. And the offset protocols have a much longer life. And so that's what I was trying to get at, that those could be sort of meshed together to provide more long-term funding for things like western wetlands restoration and compost application that are being funded in the short term, in the near term, through investment of auction revenue. The protocols generally have an initial eligibility of a 10-year ban, but that can be renewed for additional 10-year terms. So there is long-term funding availability to the offsets mechanism.
Thank you for that clarification, because I was a little confused.
But this does go to another issue that I was pointing out, the need for flexibility within these programs. The way California manages the distribution of its cap and trade revenue is that it updates its scoping plan, which is its greenhouse gas emission reduction strategy, once every 3 years. Based on that update, it produces a document called the Cap and Trade Investment Plan that describes what sorts of investments meet the strategy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That then goes through the legislative process to direct funding to individual programs. And then once the funding is directed to individual programs, it goes, or purposes rather, it goes to agency to design the programs, right? This is a very, I would call it Byzantine if I was. There's got to be a faster, easier, simpler way to do this. And I would really encourage you guys to think about how much flexibility do you want to work into your system so that you can actually respond to changes that are occurring on the ground. So let me give an example of what that means. We had a tremendous drought in California for the last 5 years. We have assuredly at least 120 million dead trees, roughly 5 million acres of landscape in California with more than 50% tree mortality, okay? But we had a 3-year cap and trade investment plan, so there was no way in that 3-year window for us to redirect funding other than an emergency action of the legislature to address the tree mortality issue, right? So, as you all know, emergency action is often not all that easy to do, right? So that sort of thing is that, I would definitely encourage enough flexibility in the system that you can, or setting a portion of the funding aside specifically to deal with essentially unforeseen circumstances.
So, Steve, you mentioned the ancillary programs that go along with the cap and trade system, things like the low carbon fuel standard. We're wrestling with our low carbon fuel standard here as we're implementing it. We seem to be on a good track for implementation, but there are people who believe that, actually counter to what you were saying about flexibility, more of the program should be actually in statute than not. So I'm just wondering how that program is working from a rural perspective, you know, in terms of raising the cost of fuel, in terms of providing other limitations on ruralites, or on the other hand, providing opportunities for economic development for ruralites.
So two observations on that, with the opening caveat that I'm not an expert on the low carbon fuel standard. My understanding is, with checking in late last year, that we had met about a 6% reduction in carbon intensity so far, somewhere between a 4% and a 6% reduction in carbon intensity of fuels. We're definitely seeing the emergence of an alternative fuel industry in California. And a lot of that industry has been focused in rural regions, not in my region of the state yet, but in the Central Valley, in the Sacramento Valley, and places like that. But you hit on another really interesting issue, which is make sure that you're planning for where people are going to be hurt the most and are vulnerable in a situation like this. If the price of gasoline and the last analysis of how much has California's climate program meant to the price of a gallon in gas in California, which was, I think, a UC Berkeley study as well, came up with the 15-cent figure. If the increase in price of gasoline is going to hurt certain communities more, think about ways that you can invest the money so that it protects those communities to the maximum amount possible, right? So in California, a portion of the cap and trade program is going to essentially pay for charging networks and fuel electric vehicle availability, rather, in disadvantaged communities, right? This is a tough one in rural regions. If the price of gasoline for me goes up 15 cents a gallon, I'm lucky where I am, but a lot of people in my region have to drive 40 miles to get to a grocery store, you know, or further, right? Rural people have higher vehicle miles traveled because the distance between services is greater. So you need to find ways to, I wouldn't necessarily say compensate, but I would definitely say plan for that impact in rural regions and try to find a way to make it softer, you know. And if you have other fuel taxes that are tied to that as well, then it's even more difficult, right? California just passed basically a 20 cent per gallon fuel tax increase to pay for highway maintenance. So.
And so another example would be with home heating fuel. The rate may be going up, but if you're making the homes more efficient,
exactly,
they're actually paying not more.
Well, and that actually is an interesting, and we were talking about this over at the Association of Oregon Counties meeting, and I think somebody kind of, I might have almost turned their head around when I said, you know, our objective here actually should be to make energy so cheap that it doesn't matter, like, so cheap and so clean that it essentially doesn't matter how much we use, right? So, you know, there is a tipping point here. What we want to have happen is we want to have enough innovation in these fields that we actually have abundance rather than scarcity, right? And we are beginning to see that turning in certain renewable energy fields. The price of solar has come down so much, it is competing with natural gas. Even natural gas, everyone said there was no way in the world it would ever compete with natural gas. And it is beginning to compete with natural gas. You know, that should be our long-term objective, advance innovation to the point that this doesn't hurt rural communities or disadvantaged communities or low-income households, et cetera, you know.
Senator Robin.
Thank you. Again, I'm seeing the investment in these rural communities and producing some jobs, but these don't seem like sustainable jobs. So we will continue to see the number of people living in these rural areas diminish. How do we get sustainable rural communities in these places, or are we destined in these old timber-dependent places where there's not going to be timber jobs? Are we just trying to figure out a way to ease them into metropolitan areas and out of those areas because there won't be any sustainable jobs in the long term in rural areas?
Yeah, I would argue not at all. That's okay. The opposite of what I want to achieve.
I would
frankly.
Say opposite of what I want.
But I would also say, I don't think that's necessarily solely a climate investment issue, right? I mean, what you're really talking about is how do you reverse the trend to less economic opportunity and declining populations in rural regions? And, you know, that is a lot of the work that our Small Business Development Center and our organization focuses on, and it's about a lot more than just these types of investments. It's about career technical education. It's about broadband availability and deployment in rural places so people have access to high-speed data and communications, right? It's about things like improving the capacity of rural businesses to compete in global or regional markets. You know, that is that technical assistance side for businesses to expand. You know, to some extent, it's about investing in things like advanced manufacturing in rural regions. We've lost so much of our manufacturing base overseas. Beginning to understand how we can get some of that back as prices increase in other areas. Like, you've got a really big issue there that you asked me about that I'm very passionate about, but isn't necessarily solely a climate issue. But I'm with you. Like, I want to see a revival in rural America and good middle-class, middle-income, socially mobile jobs. That's what we need in rural regions. And climate adaptation and mitigation can be a piece of that. That's going to take a lot of strategies, but climate can be a big piece of that.
Okay, maybe this will be the last question. Rep. Polvi.
Oh, I just wanted to thank you for being here. I found your presentation really exciting, believe it or not, and I just really appreciate your input. I wish we could draft you for the Oregon business conversation as well.
Okay. Well, Steve, Arjun, thank you. Thank you both very much. I know that you will always be there as a resource for us if we have added questions, and appreciate that. Thank you for giving us your time. Colleagues, I want to say for those of you who are on the Senate side, we had another informational hearing scheduled for Wednesday. It was our rescheduled session on advanced wood products, which we were kind of talking about. But the health condition of one of the major presenters is still not there for us. So we're going to put that off actually until September ledge days. Yes, so, Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I saw that had come through and also noticed that there was an article, I believe it was in the Register of Guards business section, talking about the building that's going up in Portland, 10 stories or 12 story.
Yeah.
It's a very nice story.
It is. It is really exciting. And that's
CLT.
I would encourage you to.
We
yes,
love it.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we're going to reschedule that for September ledge days. We're talking about maybe having that be a joint hearing as well. But stay tuned for that. Yes, Senator Roblin?
I was concerned about one of our members because he hadn't said a word, and I just was making sure he was okay. Are you still okay, Senator Representative Smith?
Oh, Senator.
Love over here. We just want to.
You know, I made a deal with the chair that I would.
He's going to keep up his bargain.
I appreciate that, knowing that. Thank you.
Yes, we passed your bills, Representative.
No, I appreciate the presentation. Thank you for your time. And
it's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, so. The reason that Representative Power is vice chairing is because of illness that the chair, Rep. Helm, is experiencing. But hopefully he'll be with us soon. And Representative Bentz, of course, experiencing a serious issue that he seems to be as usual, triumphing over, we're happy to hear. So our best wishes to them both. So with that, from a Senate perspective, we are adjourned.
On the House side as well.
Yeah.
On the House side as well.